I'd like to talk about a personality in the Old Testament today who is of a very interesting character. You've all heard about him. He is a proverbial person of one who has to go through trials and to go through sufferings of an unspeakable nature. Of course, I'm talking about none other than Job. And the book of Job is without any parallels in the Bible, in my opinion. It's a book which can be easily misunderstood. One has to read it very carefully, and frankly, one has to read it together with other scriptures and other concepts in order to understand it correctly. I just picked up a commentary the other day and read what they had to say about the book of Job, and I probably had to disagree with virtually everything they said in that commentary, showing again how easy it is to misunderstand what the book is all about. What I like to do in this sermon is to really go through the book of Job in a summary format, just hitting some highlights and giving you the theme and telling you about what to look for when you read that book. First of all, Job lived at the times, and this is a very broad summary now, of Abram, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Depending on who you look at, you will find all of these mentions, because nobody knows absolutely for sure when exactly he lived, but he had to live before Moses, that's clear. And so the overall feeling is that he lived at the times of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. When you go to the book of Job, chapter 1, and verse 1, you find Job being introduced in a very unique way. Job, chapter 1, and verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz. And I remember Mr. Bill Grant gave a sermonette or a split sermon or a sermon even about Job and pointed out that the famous wizard of Oz might very well have been this one. Not that he was a wizard, but the fact is that the interesting correlation with the name might very well have given rise to this story of the Wizard of Oz. Anyhow, there was this man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless and upright and one who feared God and shunned evil. Or as the margin has it, he turned away from evil. So this was a remarkable man. This was not the greatest sinner who has ever lived on the face of the earth. This was a very righteous, remarkable, upright person. And God would later state to Satan that this description of Job was absolutely correct. Notice in verse 8 of chapter 1. The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth? A blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns or turns away from evil." Now, this remarkable statement, depending on when Job lived, would have us to conclude that even the patriarchs of old weren't as diligent to avoid evil as Job was. Because God said, "There's none on the face of the earth, like my servant Job." We also see that it is actually God who points Job out to Satan. It's not Satan coming to God and starts complaining about Job, just the other way around. Satan comes in front of God, and of course, obviously he's complaining, but it is God who points out Job to Satan and says, "Have you seen my servant?" In other words, it's God who starts a conversation, and he does it for a reason. Now, what is the reason? Why did God even bring it up? Well, I'm asking some of these questions now, and we'll answer them as we go through the sermon. And in case you guessed it, there's going to be a follow-up sermon as well the following Sabbath, because I couldn't possibly cover it all in one. Now, Satan's philosophy is this, though. He says, "Well, Job is only upright. He is only blameless because you, God, protect him. You bless him. That's the reason. But once you withdraw your blessings, once you withdraw your protection, he will curse you. He will become unrighteous. He will become sinful." So Job's righteousness is selfish in the sense he only does it because he expects protection from you. Now notice how God responds to this accusation. He says pretty much, do with him as you please, but don't bring any suffering on him directly. In Job chapter 1, let's read it beginning in verse 9. Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land, so no wonder he worships you. He's righteous. Verse 11. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on this person. And so Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Notice God gives the rules here. God tells Satan how far he can go. It's not up to Satan to decide, okay, I will just do this and that. Satan knew he had to get permission from God as to how far he could go, and God tells him exactly how far he could go. Now, some say God did that because he wanted to teach Satan a lesson. But is that true? Is that why he did allow Satan to inflict pain and suffering on Job? Is man just a helpless pawn in a chess game between the gods, as some pagan religions have taught? Now, as we go on with the story, Satan begins to destroy everything that Job possesses. His cattle, his servants, yes, even his children. Notice in Job chapter 1, beginning in verse 13. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, the oxen were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them. And when the Sabaeans, or the ones from Sheba, raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you. Now, notice that this particular person is saying here that the fire of God came down from heaven to burn up the sheep and the servants. Well, in a sense, of course, it was Satan who did it, but God allowed it. And so, if you think about it, the term a fire from God wasn't incorrect. In fact, later on, Job agreed with that assessment because he attributed everything to God, and rightly so. Let's keep reading verse 17. But he was still speaking, another also came and said, the Chaldeans from three bands raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are all dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. I mean, imagine, I mean, you would be in the position Job was in, and you would get one bad news after the other like that. Only think in terms of what your reaction would be. Notice, though, what Job's reaction was in verse 20. And then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground, and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. So he contributes everything which happened to him to God. And he was correct in doing that because he knew that nothing could happen which God wouldn't allow. And so, in verse 22, this is confirmed. Because we read, in all this, Job did not sin, nor charge God with wrong. So it wasn't wrong for him to say, God took it away from him. That was correct, because God allowed Satan to do it. And if God wouldn't have allowed Satan to do it, Satan couldn't have done it. But again, we ask, why? Why did God allow Satan to plague Job in such a terrible way he did? And unfortunately, Satan wasn't done yet. And neither was God. Because in the next chapter, Satan appears again in front of God. And it is again God who brings up Job to Satan. Job chapter 2 and verse 3. The Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil, and still he holds fast to his integrity, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause? Now, I have to tell you, brethren, I have puzzled over this passage for a long, long time. What did God mean when he said, you have incited to destroy him without cause? Did God have no cause to allow Satan to plague Job? There was no reason whatsoever? Well, unfortunately, that's not what it says, but the translation here is very unclear. Let me read to you how other translations put it. The New Jerusalem Bible says, you achieved nothing by provoking me to ruin him. It wasn't like that God had no cause. God was telling Satan, you achieved nothing. What you did to Job did not prove your case. The Moffat translation says, it was idle of you to entice me to undo him. And the German Potloch Bible says, you have enticed me in vain to ruin him. That is, in spite of the sufferings that Job had to endure, he did not sin against God, as we had just read. Now, in addition, of course, Satan hadn't given God a reason to destroy Job. In other words, the reason that Satan had given, oh, you take away whatever he has and he will curse you, that reason didn't materialize. That was not correct. And so God is telling Satan, well, you know, your philosophy is wrong. Job did not curse me, even though I allowed you to bring trial and suffering upon him. But let me ask you again, does this then mean that God had no reason to let those things happen to Job? Well, interestingly enough, as we will see, Job, in fact, began to believe that. As we go through the book, we will find that he believed that God had no reason to do that, that God was unjust in allowing this to happen. He says, God brings this upon me without cause. He says, God deals in an unrighteous manner with me. He says, God's wrong. I am right. Now, first let's see what Satan's response is to God in Job chapter 2, beginning in verse 4. Job 2 and verse 4. So Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, but spare his life. So again, we see God directs and controls how far Satan can go. And so we read then in the rest of this chapter that Satan inflicts Job with terrible diseases, something he would also later do with Paul, if you will recall, when he gave Paul a thorn in the flesh. And again, we'll need to ask, why did God allow that to happen with Job and later even with Paul? Now, as events unfold, Job's wife positions herself against her husband. And sometimes that happens in a marriage, that one maid positions herself against his or her mate, not agreeing. And, of course, that didn't help in the situation. Notice in chapter 2, beginning in verse 9. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks." Now notice carefully, he didn't say, "You are a foolish woman." He was very polite in his response. He says, "You speak as one of the foolish women speaks." He goes on to say, "Shall we indeed accept good from God, and shall we not accept adversity?" In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. Now, that's an interesting addition. First, he said, he didn't sin, nor charge God his wrong. Now it says, he didn't sin with his lips. No, he didn't say anything which was sinful, but what about his thoughts? Had he started to begin to wonder too a little bit? What's happening here? Why is God allowing this to happen? Is God fair? Well, we now introduce to Job's three friends. They come to comfort Job. Well, first they see Job in his pain, and so, I believe for a week or so, nobody says anything. They are just absolutely horrified by the terrible plague Job is going through. And then it is Job, actually, who begins to speak in chapter 3, beginning in verse 1. "After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. And Job spoke and said, 'May the day perish on which I was born, and the night in which it was said, a male child is conceived.'" Now, that's very interesting here, that he curses the day of his birth, or you might say his birthday, because in chapter 1 and in verse 4, if you go back with me to that passage, we find that his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their three sisters to eat and drink with them. And so many commentaries point out that the sons actually celebrated their birthdays. And here Job is cursing his birthday. And we also notice that when the sons did that, and the daughters as well, what Job's reaction was, if you look at Job chapter 1 and verse 5. "And so it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all," showing that he had to live before Moses, because he was still allowed, in a sense, to offer burnt offerings himself. "For Job said, 'It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts.' And thus did Job regularly." Now, again, he didn't say they did sin when they had this feast on their birthday, but he said maybe they did. Why did he fear that? Because birthday celebrations tend to focus on the I, on the me. They generate pride, self-centeredness, honor taken upon yourself. It's a day of get, not a day to give somebody. And so he was afraid that maybe that spirit had overtaken them, and so he would give an offering asking God to forgive them, if in fact that's what they had come to. But now he curses his own birthday. He didn't want to live any longer. It was just too much. And so here came the friends, and they wanted to comfort Job. But as we will see, as was the case with his wife, they too only poured oil in the fire. Let's briefly summarize the first speech of his first friend, Eliphaz, in Job chapter 4. Let me just hit a highlight here in verse 7. Notice Eliphaz's philosophy. Notice how he comforted Job. Job 4 and verse 7. "Remember now, whoever perished being innocent? Or where was the upright ever cut off? Even as I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same." So what Eliphaz was telling Job, in effect, was, "You, Job, have sinned. You're not blameless. That is why you are suffering." Now, the concept that sin brings forth penalties and wrong developments is correct. However, it didn't apply here. You know, we have seen from the outset, God didn't bring this about to punish Job for a sin. Let's keep reading in chapter 5, verses 7 to 8. Because Eliphaz isn't done yet. He says, "Yet man is born to trouble, as the sparks fly upwards. But as for me, I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause." In other words, Job, you're not doing that. You're not going to God to ask him, so I would do that if I were you, Job, and God would take away all these plagues from you immediately. Now, notice how Job responds to that speech, and you find his response in chapter 6. Notice verse 24. He says, "Teach me, and I will hold my tongue. Cause me to understand wherein I have erred." In other words, if I have sinned, tell me what it is I have sinned in, so I can make amends. And he also gives him the following admonition in verse 14 of chapter 6. "To him who is afflicted or despairing, kindness should be shown by his friend." Not accusations, not wild accusations, unfounded accusations, but kindness. It goes on to say, "even though even forsakes the fear of the Almighty." In other words, a true friend will show kindness. Job longs for comfort. I mean, picture him. He lost everything he had. He is there in terrible pain and suffering. And here come the friends, and the first thing the friend says, he accuses him of wrongdoing. And Job is saying, "No, I want mercy. I want comfort. I don't want and I don't need this condemnation from my friends, and on top of that, unjustified condemnation. Because if I have sinned, you tell me in what way I have sinned," and not make these general statements. Job looked for mercy. He didn't find it in his friends, but as we go on with the story, we'll find that ultimately he did receive it from God. But notice now, Job chapter 7, verse 20, how he continues. He says, "Have I sinned? What have I done to you?" Now, he speaks to God. I mean, he doesn't necessarily think that speaking to his friend Eliphaz is helping too much, so he speaks to God. He turns to God. He says, "What have I done to you, O watcher of men? Why have you set me as your target so that I am a burden to myself? Why then do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I will lie down in the dust, and you will seek me diligently, and I will no longer be." See, Job directs his question to God because he can't find any answers from his friends, Eliphaz. Now, if you're not reading this carefully, this may sound as if Job considers the possibility that he might have sinned and that God is punishing him for that. But that's not the case. Job is saying here, "Even if I had sinned, you, God, should leave me alone. What is it to you, God, whether I sin or not?" Was pretty much his attitude in this regard. So now we come to Job's second friend, Bildad. And he begins his first speech in chapter 8. Let's read verses 3 and 4. He's asking Job, "Does God subvert judgment, or does the Almighty pervert justice? If your sons have sinned against him, he has cast them away for their transgression." Now he becomes really outspoken here. He says, "Well, your sons died because they sinned against God." No evidence for that whatsoever. Even Job didn't believe that. But Bildad's philosophy is, "Only the one who sins suffers and perishes. Therefore, you, Job, must have sinned. Your sons must have sinned because they and you suffer." The sons even died. "God is punishing you for your sins." So again, it's in a sense a repetition of Eliphaz's concept. Now again, that didn't help much. And so Job answers in chapter 9, beginning in verse 15. For though I were righteous, I could not answer him. I would beg mercy of my judge. If I called and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. For he crushes me with a tempest and multiplies my wounds without cause. So that's Job's concept. Again, he is addressing his complaints to God. And he's telling God, you punish me without cause. There's no reason for you to do that to me. You act unrighteously to me. Even if I could speak to him, he wouldn't listen. I couldn't explain my case to him because he just wouldn't listen. In Job chapter 9, verse 27, he goes on, if I say, I will forget my complaints, I will put off my sad face and wear a smile, I'm afraid of all my sufferings, I know that you will not hold me innocent. If I am condemned, why then do I labor in vain? Or as other translations have it here, I am held guilty. Why do I labor in vain? Verse 30, if I wash myself with snow water and cleanse my hands with soap, yet you will plunge me into the pit, and my own clothes will abhor me. Verse 32, for he is not a man as I am, that I may answer him, and that we should go to court together. So again, the same idea. God is not going to listen to me. I know I am innocent. I know God is wrong in allowing this to happen to me, but he wouldn't listen to me even if I were to explain my case to him. And so again, as his two friends have not been able to give him any answers, he is directing his complaint to God. And in chapter 10, beginning in verse 2, that's what he says. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. Does it seem good to you that you should oppress, that you should despise the work of your hands and smile on the counsel of the wicked? Do you have eyes of flesh, or do you see as man sees? Are your days like the days of a mortal man? Are your years like the days of a mighty man, that you should seek for my iniquity and search out my sin, although you know that I am not wicked, and there is no one who can deliver from your hands? But then notice what he says in chapter 13, verses 18 and 19. See now, I have prepared my case. I know that I shall be vindicated. Who is he who will contend with me? If now I hold my tongue, I perish. Now he includes God here. He says, not even God can contend with me. I am innocent. He is not fair in dealing in the way he does. But once I'll tell him, he will correct his error. Now, we may smile at that when we read it from a distance, when we read it not being involved in the situation, but you ask yourself, when you go through trials, serious trials, and I don't believe that anyone went through the trials Job went through, of course, Jesus Christ being accepted, don't we sometimes react like that? Don't we sometimes feel, well, God isn't fair? Why does he allow that to happen to me? I'm trying the best I can to be submissive to him, to be obedient to him, and he allows these things to happen to me. If I could only tell God how wrong he is, I would love to do it. And so he continues arguing with God in chapter 13, beginning in verse 23. How many are my iniquities and sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Why do you hide your face and regard me as your enemy? Will you frighten a leaf driven to and fro, and will you pursue dry stubble? Verse 26, for you write bitter things against me and make me inherit the iniquities of my youth. Chapter 14, beginning in verse 14. If a man dies, shall he live again? All the days of my heart's service I will wait till my change comes. You shall call, and I will answer you, and you shall desire the work of your hands. For now you number my steps, but do not watch over my sin. My transgression is sealed up in a bag, and you cover my iniquity. Now he's talking about his resurrection, but he's also giving the point to say to God, look, even if I had sinned, you should have forgiven that a long time ago. There's no cause for you, no reason for you to do to me what you're doing. Of course, he also makes it very clear that he says, I am totally innocent. So why do you do this to me? In Job chapter 15, here comes our friend Eliphaz, and he tries it a second time. Chapter 15 and verse 5. Nothing new, actually, only stronger condemnation. Chapter 15 and verse 5. For your iniquity teaches your mouth, and you choose the tongue of the crafty. And so Job's answer is not new either. Chapter 16 and verse 2. He says, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. Verse 4. I also could speak as you do. If your soul were in my soul's place, in other words, if you would go through the suffering I am going through, I could make these kind of statements to you. But what good would that be? What good would it do? He says, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. But he says, I wouldn't do that. He says, I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the comfort of my lips would relieve your grief. Now, whether he in fact would have done this, I don't know, but he says that's at least what he would expect his friends, his comforters, to do. Not to condemn him, but to comfort him in the true sense of the word. And then he turns back to God. But again, with the premise, I'm innocent, and you, God, act wrongly toward me. Chapter 16, verse 16. My face is flushed from weeping, and on my eyelids is a shadow of death. Although no violence is in my hands, my prayer is pure. Verse 19. Surely even now my witness is in heaven, and my evidence is on high. My friends scorn me, my eyes pour out tears to God. Oh, that one might plead for a man with God as a man pleads for his neighbor. In other words, there should be somebody up there in heaven who pleads my case, proving to you, God, that I am innocent, is what he is saying. In chapter 17 and verse 3. Now put down a pledge for me with yourself. Who is he who will shake hands with me? In other words, who is there to shake hands with me to defend me? He is asking for a mediator, for somebody who would come to his rescue to show God that God was wrong and that Job was right. The idea is, you, God, defend me. No one else will. And once you really look into this, once you really understand what you're doing, then you should understand that what you're doing is wrong, that I am innocent, and you will uphold my innocence. Now, in Job chapter 18, we are introduced to Bildad's second speech. But that doesn't give us anything new either, because his philosophy is, only the wicked suffer, and since you, Job, suffer, you have to be wicked. Chapter 18, verse 21. Surely, such are the dwellings of the wicked. And this is a place of him who doesn't know God. See, now Job didn't even know God anymore, according to Bildad. I mean, here was the most righteous person on the face of the earth. He had become the most wicked person on the face of the earth in the eyes of his friends who had come to comfort Job. And Job's response doesn't give us anything new either. In chapter 19, verse 4. If indeed I have erred, my error remains with me. Verse 6. Know then that God has wronged me and has surrounded me with his net. So now Job becomes very specific in his defense. He's becoming desperate. He doesn't know how to defend himself. He knows that what's happening to him couldn't be because he's an extremely wicked person. So now his conclusion has to be God has done me wrong. But then he also gives his friends again a very appropriate admonition in chapter 19 and verse 21. Have pity on me. Have pity on me, O you my friends, for the hand of God has struck me. Verse 28. If you should say, how shall we persecute him, since the root of the matter is found in me, or how can we find a matter against him, is really what he's saying. Verse 29. Be afraid of the sword for yourselves. For wrath brings the punishment of the sword, that you may know there is a judgment. So he is warning his friends. He's saying, you better be careful what you're saying, because God may turn his wrath from me and will pour it out over you because of the way you act towards me. And that was a very appropriate advice here Job was giving to his friends. But now, here comes Zophar's second speech in chapter 20. And again, he concludes with the same accusation. You, Job, are wicked. Plain and simple. Job 20, verse 29. This is a portion from God for a wicked man, the heritage appointed to him by God. So what you got even less than what you deserve. And so Job's answer in chapter 21 concludes again with Job's correct analysis, chapter 21 and verse 34. How then can you comfort me with empty words, since falsehood remains in your answers? See, the friends hadn't been able to tell Job at all why he was suffering, but they just condemned him. And now comes Eliphaz's third speech, beginning in chapter 22. And now he begins to become very specific with very wrong condemnations and accusations. But none of that was true. And Job knew that. Notice chapter 22, beginning in verse 4. And you know, when we have a certain philosophy, we can become extremely aggressive if our philosophy doesn't meet the approval of the one we want to talk to. And we know we are right. And so this other person doesn't accept it. And so we might become very, very aggressive. And that is what Eliphaz, in his quote-unquote despair for not getting the point across, he wanted to get a point, wanted to get across to Job, says. But all of what he said was wrong. Job 22, beginning in verse 4. Is it because of your fear of him that he corrects you and enters into judgment with you? Is not your wickedness great and your iniquity without end? For you have taken pledges from your brother for no reason. You have stripped the naked of their clothing. You have not given the weary water to drink, and you have withheld bread from the hungry. But the mighty man possessed the land, and the honorable man dwelt in it. You have sent widows away empty, and the strength of the fatherless was crushed. Verse 10, therefore, because you have done all these sins, therefore snares are all around you, and sudden fear troubles you. Verse 23, but if you return to the Almighty, you will be built up. You will remove iniquity far from your tents. Very specific accusations, condemnations, none of which were true. And so Job doesn't even bother anymore trying to answer this guy. And so he answers directly to God in chapter 23, beginning in verse 3. Oh, that I knew where I might find him, that I might come to his seat. I would present my case before him and fill my mouth with arguments. So I'm going to teach God about myself and about justice. And God will finally understand how wrong he is in treating me the way he does. And here comes Bildad's third speech in chapter 25. It's very short because he doesn't have much to say anymore. In chapter 25 and verse 4, he repeats again what he has been saying all along. How then can man be righteous before God? Or how can he be pure who is born of a woman? So, since man can't be pure, you, Job, can't be pure, therefore you must have sinned, therefore God is punishing you. Now, Job's answer to this covers the next six chapters. from Job chapter 26 all the way up to Job chapter 31. Of course, I can't read them all right now. I just want to hit some highlights. Job chapter 27, beginning in verse 2. As God lives, who has taken away my justice, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me and the breath of God in my nostrils, my lips will not speak wickedness, nor my tongue utter deceit. Far be it from me that I should say, you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my iniquity. I will not put away my integrity from me. My righteousness I hold fast and will not let it go. Here we get an inkling of the problem Job was suffering from. If he had said, your righteousness, God, I hold fast, that would have been an appropriate statement. But no, he says, my righteousness I hold fast. God says that our righteousness is nothing but filthy garments in his mind. Paul was talking about the fact that he had to replace his righteousness with the righteousness of God. Notice in chapter 29, verse 14. I put on righteousness, but which ones? And it closed me. My justice was like a rope and a turban. Chapter 31, beginning in verse 1. And now he is giving a list of things he did do and didn't do, trying to make the point he hadn't sinned the way these three friends had accused him of. And I believe everything he says in here is true. There's no reason to doubt that he didn't do any of those things. Notice Job chapter 31, verse 1. I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? See, Job was married, and so he did not want to look at another woman, obviously, with evil thoughts. So he said, I'm not going to even do that. Christ later on would say, you know, if you look at another woman with evil thoughts, you have already committed adultery in your heart. Verse 9 of the same chapter. If my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I have lurked at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another, and let others bow down over her, for that would be wickedness. Yes, it would be iniquity deserving of judgment. Verse 16. If I have kept the poor from their desire, or caused the eyes of the widow to fail, or eaten my morsel by myself, so that the fatherless could not eat of it. Verse 19. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or any poor man without covering. Verse 22. In other words, he wouldn't help him. Then let my arm fall from my shoulder. Let my arm be torn from the socket. Verse 26. If I have observed the sun when it shines, or the moon moving in brightness, so that my heart has been secretly enticed, and my mouth has kissed my hand, this also would be an iniquity deserving of judgment, for I would have denied God who is above. In other words, if he would have committed idolatry. If I have rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me. Now, he is becoming very specific, and how many of us can say that? How many of us could actually list these kind of things and say, like Job, oh, I've never done any of this. If I have rejoiced at the destruction of him who hated me, or lifted myself up when evil found him, indeed I have not allowed my mouth to sin by asking for a curse on his soul. In other words, he said, even that was not allowed, even that I didn't do. If the man of my tent have not said, who is there that has not been satisfied with his meat? No sojourner had to lodge in the street. I have opened my doors to the traveler. If I have covered my transgressions as Adam, by hiding my iniquity in my bosom, because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of family, so that I kept silence and didn't go out the door, all that I had one to hear me. In other words, he said, I haven't done any of this. And I believe he was correct in his statement. So, no way was he that wicked, evil person the three friends made him out to be. Job is giving evidence for his innocence. But notice what he is listing here. He is listing deeds, what he did and didn't do. And he also is listing motives which could have gone to and produced certain deeds if he wouldn't have controlled them. So he didn't do any unrighteous deeds, and in a sense, he didn't even have any unrighteous thoughts. But now notice Job chapter 31 and verse 6. Let me be weighed on honest scales, that God may know my iniquity. In other words, God, you're not weighing me on honest scales. Verse 35. Oh, that I had one to hear me. Here is my mark. Oh, that the Almighty would answer me, that my prosecutor had written a book. Surely he would carry it on my, surely I would carry it on my shoulder and bend it on me like a crown. I would declare to him the number of my steps like a prince. I would approach him. In other words, they could write everything down I've ever done, and it would be to my glory, because you wouldn't find any sin whatsoever. I'm totally innocent. And if God would only be willing to look at that kind of a book, he would have to agree with me. So again, Job's attitude was very clearly that I haven't sinned. I am righteous. I am incapable of sinning. I am innocent. In spite of this, I suffer. Therefore, God does me wrong. God is unrighteous. If I only could talk to him, I would make this clear to him, and he would understand, and he would repent. Beginning in Job chapter 32, we begin to see some of the answers to Job's problems and some of the lessons in the book of Job. Job chapter 32, beginning in verse 1, because here we are introduced to another person who wasn't introduced before. His name is Elihu. But beginning in chapter 32, beginning in verse 1, so the three men ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. Then the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite of the family of Ram, was aroused against Job. His wrath was aroused because he justified himself rather than God. And also against the three friends, his wrath was aroused because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. Notice what Elihu sensed. He sensed that Job justified himself rather than God. A better translation here is, Job considered himself more righteous than God. Notice he had said, my righteousness I won't let go. So was his righteousness of a higher degree than God's? Apparently that's how Job felt. The Amplified Bible translates this verse, he made himself out to be better than God. And that is why Elihu became angry. And of course his three friends had condemned him, although they couldn't figure out why Job had to suffer. And so now we are introduced to the speeches of Elihu, and I want you to notice that Elihu, apparently, he might have been there all the time, but he was quiet. He apparently was a younger person. He gave, first of all, credence to the older friends to speak. And later we see that God would condemn the three friends. He would not condemn Elihu. So whatever Elihu said here did not deserve God's condemnation. And so we find that Elihu speaks from chapter 33 all the way up to chapter 37. And these speeches then lead immediately to God's answer, beginning in chapter 38, so there's no interlude here by Job responding. And what Elihu does is what God would later also do. He would quote some of Job's statements, some of the things Job has said, and then he explains to him why he was incorrect in what he had said. And so in Job chapter 33, beginning in verse 8, he's saying, surely you have spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the sound of your words, saying, I am pure, without transgression, I am innocent, and there is no iniquity in me. Yet he finds occasion against me, he counts me as his enemy, he puts my feet in the stocks, he watches all my paths. This is what Job had said. Elijah goes on to say in verse 12, look, in this you are not righteous. I will answer you. For God is greater than man. Why do you contend with him? For he doesn't give an accounting of any of his words. In other words, since when does God have to answer anyone for what he does? Not that God sometimes doesn't answer, but to demand it, is Elijah was saying, it's not really your right. Chapter 34, beginning in verse 5. For Job has said, and so he quotes him again, I am righteous, but God has taken away my justice. Should I lie concerning my rights? My wound is incurable, though I am without transgression. And so in verse 10, he says, therefore listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do wickedness, and from the Almighty to commit iniquity. Verse 12, surely God will never do wickedness or wickedly, nor will the Almighty pervert justice. See, rather than starting to condemn Job for sins he hadn't committed, Elihu concentrates on the righteousness of God and shows that God, no matter what he does, couldn't possibly have done something unrighteously. In chapter 35, beginning at verse 1, moreover, Elihu answered and said, do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? So he puts his finger on Job's problem, because that's exactly what Job was saying. My righteousness is more, is better than God's. Chapter 36, verse 22. Behold, God is exalted by his power. Who teaches like him? Who has assigned him his way? Or who has said, you have done wrong? Well, I mean, Job had said that. And Elijah was telling him, well, you really shouldn't have said that. Job chapter 37 and verse 23. As for the Almighty, we cannot find him. He is excellent in power, in judgment, and abundant justice. He doesn't oppress. And that's pretty much all Elihu is saying. He's not condemning Job in any way. He's just telling Job, look, no matter what we are going through in our lives, we should never forget that God, who is the creator of us all, who is working with us, knows what he's doing. And so God picks up where Elihu leaves off. In chapter 38, now we hear God's answer. Now that's what Job had been waiting for. He just wanted to have the opportunity to talk to God and to tell him how wrong he was. Well, notice how God starts. Job chapter 38 and verse 1. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me, God is saying. So God answers Job. You see, Job was so anxious to teach God, to show God how wrong he was. And so we see that Job's righteousness, because he was righteous, based on human standards, even based on God's standards, insofar as the way he lived was concerned. But that had created pride in him. It had created the thought in him he was incapable of sinning. His righteousness was more than even God's. He thought he was smarter and wiser and more righteous, more powerful than God. And so notice how God answers that problem. Chapter 38, verse 4. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Or who stretched the line upon it? Verse 12. Have you commanded the morning since your days began, and caused the dawn to know its place? Verse 16. Have you entered the springs of the sea? Or have you walked in search of the depth? Verse 18. Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth? Tell me, if you know all this. Verse 22. Have you entered the treasury of snow, or have you seen the treasury of hail? Verse 31. Can you bind the cluster of the Pleiades, I believe it's pronounced, or loose the belt of Orion? Can you bring out Matharoth in its season? Or you, can you guide the great bear with its cubs, talking about these constellations of the stars? Verse 33. Do you know the ordinances of the heavens? Can you set the dominion over the earth? Can you lift up your voice to the clouds that an abundance of water may cover you? Verse 35. Can you send out lightnings that they may go and say to you, here we are? Verse 39. Can you hunt the prey for the lion or satisfy the appetite of the young lions? Chapter 39, verse 1. Do you know the time when the wild mountain goats bear young? Or can you mark when the deer gives birth? Can you number the months that they fulfill? Or do you know the time when they bear young? Verse 10. Can you bind the wild ox and the furrow with ropes? Or will he plow the valleys behind you? Verse 19. Have you given the horse strength? Have you closed his neck with thunder? Verse 20. Can you frighten him like a locust? His majestic snorting strikes terror. Verse 26. Does a hawk fly by your wisdom and spread its wings towards the south? Does the eagle mount up at your command and make its nest on high? These are just some of the questions God is asking Job. What God is doing here is to give Job a proper perspective. He shows him how little, how small, how powerless he is in comparison with God. And by showing God's great wisdom and power in comparison to Job's small wisdom and power, God shows him that man can't really argue or contend with God about what God is doing. After all, it was God who created man. It wasn't man who created God. Chapter 40 and verse 2. Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it. So he's telling Job, here, here's your chance now after you have corrected me or tried to correct me, contend with me. Okay, tell me now. And so here comes Job's response. That's what he had been waiting for throughout the book, right? To just tell God how wrong he was. Chapter 40, verse 3. Then Job answered the Lord and said, behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth. Once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further. Now, God isn't finished yet. He drove a lesson home, but sometimes it takes more than just one attempt to make it really stick. And so Job is being confronted by God's further questions. Chapter 40, beginning in verse 7. Now prepare yourself like a man. I will question you, and you shall answer me. Verse 8. Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? And you see, that was a problem Job had. He thought he was right. Therefore, God had to be wrong. And he tried to convince his friends, and he tried to convince himself, and he thought he could convince God. But you see, God doesn't even necessarily answer that. You don't even find in the book that God tells Job in so many words what was happening. We don't know that Job knew about this confrontation God had with Satan. But God does something else. God shows Job his great power, his great might, his great wisdom. And that should have been and actually was sufficient for Job. In chapter 40 and verse 9, have you an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his? Chapter 41, verse 1. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? Or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Verse 7. Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? And so again and again, God is asking Job questions like, do you know? Do you comprehend? Can you do that? Have you commanded them to do that? He shows him what Job all didn't know, what Job all couldn't do. And he shows him that actually when it came to God, there was nothing God couldn't do, and there was nothing God didn't know. And so what is Job's answer in chapter 42, beginning in verse 2? Here comes the answer we were all waiting for and hoping for, if you hadn't read the book before. Here comes Job's answer. I know that you can do everything, and that no purpose of yours can be withheld from you. You asked, who is this who hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, I will answer you, and you shall answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes cease, or now my eye sees you. Therefore I abhor or despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. You see, now Job had seen God. Now he had understood that God can do everything, that nothing is impossible for him, and that he does everything with godly wisdom. And now Job declares himself guilty. Not because of what he had done, but because of his picture of God and trying to stay on the same level with God and actually trying to say that he was more knowledgeable and righteous than God. But now he declares himself guilty. Now he repents of the fact that he didn't speak wisely when he charged God with wrong. And notice what God tells Job's three friends in Job chapter 42, beginning in verse 7. And so it was, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, because he was apparently the spokesman of the three, the oldest, my wrath is aroused against you and your two friends, for you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. Now therefore take for yourself 7 bulls and 7 rams, go to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept him, lest I deal with you accounting or according to your folly, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has. And so Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamathite went and did as the Lord commanded them, for the Lord had accepted Job. Now, we have seen through the book that Job hasn't always spoken what was right. But he spoke what was right when he repented, when he accepted and acknowledged God's wisdom and power. As I said, he didn't speak right in everything he had said earlier. God had rebuked him for that through all these chapters. But Job had answered wisely and has said, I have spoken unwisely. I have said things I didn't understand. And so he said, I abhor myself. I'm sorry that I have said these things. I shouldn't have. I shouldn't even have thought them. Please forgive me. And God did. Now, we don't see that in the friends, though. I mean, we don't see that they had the same kind of reaction. They condemned Job, and they accused him of sins he hadn't committed. And they were not able to answer Job's question why he was suffering, but they condemned him nevertheless, assuming that he had to be that way because of sins, specific sins they came up with, which allegedly Job had committed, which he hadn't. And so when Job prayed for the three friends, God changed Job's situation. Notice this. Job had to pray for his three friends. And then God changed Job's situation. And he blessed him with more than he had before. He gave him twice as many sheep, camels, oxen, and donkeys, and he gave him again 7 sons and 3 daughters. So when we summarize at this point what we have learned so far from the book of Job, then we can say the following. Job was described by God as a blameless and upright man, fearing God and shunning evil. and he suffered trials from Satan. God allowed them, but Satan was the instigator. The three friends condemned Job, although they had no answers. Job had asked them repeatedly, but without success, to show him his sins, as well as to show him mercy and compassion. Job had thought that he was more righteous than God. He wanted to tell God that he made a terrible mistake in dealing with Job the way he did. And we have to ask ourselves the question, do we act sometimes the way Job did when we go through trials? But you see, ultimately, God spoke to Job. And when he showed him his wisdom, his power, his greatness, Job declared himself guilty. And he repented in dust and in ashes. In chapter 42 and verse 11, we read, "Then all his brothers, all his sisters, and all those who had been his acquaintances before came to him and ate food with him in his house, and they consoled him and comforted him for all the adversity that the Lord had brought upon him. And each one gave him a piece of silver and each a ring of gold." Now they came, after God had restored Job to his prior glory. Where were they when Job went through his trial? They didn't comfort him then. Now they comforted him. It's sometimes easy to do that when everything is all right again. It's sometimes difficult to do it when it's not that convenient. But let me ask a question in conclusion to this sermon. Why did God do it? What exactly was it Job repented of? Why did God allow Satan to inflict Job with these terrible trials? Was it indeed, as Job had said, God is doing it without cause? Now, we have answered some of the questions, but by far not all of them. And I will try to do that in the next sermon, next time.